"This is not about you," she says to Edward. "This is about me and my choices." But that still doesn't explain what's really going on now. Every age gets the vampire it needs, feminist author Nina Auerbach wrote in her book, Our Vampires Ourselves. Every age uses vampires to express their fears and concerns, writes Eric Newsom in his book, The Dead Travel Fast. In 1897, when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, England had the largest ports in the world. There was fear of incoming disease, of foreigners, of immigration, and Stoker created the perfect monster, Eastern European, bringing dirt from a foreign land. You can do this for every period that has had a wave of interest in vampires. In the 1980s, with AIDS, for example, vampires were often described as parasites. You became infected by vampirism like a disease. And the first vampire novel, story rather, in the English language, was started in 1816 in the same chalet on the same weekend that Mary Shelley started to write Frankenstein. The fear at that time was science replacing God. So what's happening now? Who are the vampires we have created? And what are the fears and concerns they are expressing? Look at our modern vampires, most of those of the last 15 years. The Cullens in Twilight, Bill Compton and Eric Northman in True Blood, Mick St. John in that wonderful CBS one-season series Moonlight, Mitchell, the vampire in the BBC series Being Human, Henry Fitzroy in Blood Ties by Tanya Huff, Stefan and Damon in the television show The Vampire Diaries, and let's not forget Angel and Spike in Buffy. They all have something in common that makes them different than most vampires that went before. When I put their names in a line on a piece of paper, it was like a light bulb suddenly went off. Unlike the vampires that went before, they're all struggling desperately to be moral, despite being predators. Often failing, sometimes succeeding, but all engaged in a profound struggle to lead a moral life despite their need for blood. There's a wonderful scene in the presidential vampire thriller Blood Oath by Christopher Farnsworth, which came out a couple years ago. The idea is that President Andrew Johnson found a vampire on a ship and imprisoned him. He managed to get Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans, to bind him by a blood oath to serve every president of the United States. Nathaniel Cade, the vampire, is now in the modern world serving a president somewhat like Obama. In one scene, he stands in the back of an AA meeting. He does this pretty regularly because he sees himself as an addict. And while he only drinks animal blood, he still lusts for the blood of humans. We humans are addicts, not only in the obvious ways, abusing alcohol and cigarettes and drugs and food. We are clearly in a struggle with an addictive lifestyle. 8 U.S. presidents in a row have claimed they would bring about the end of our dependence on foreign oil, and they've meant it, just like a smoker means it when he insists he will quit. But our jobs, the economy, the way we live and commute, the way our infrastructure is set up, all compromise us. We depend, at least for now, on continuing an addictive relationship to fossil fuels. Oil is our blood, and our addiction compromises the earth. Vampires are exactly us right now, as we wage wars, use oil, and suck the lifeblood out of the planet. Whitley Strieber, author of The Hunger, goes even further. He says, our prey is the planet. If so, vampires are us, and the issue before us is how we can learn to use our formidable powers without destroying the world and future generations. Like vampires, we are in a struggle with our own predation. You may ask, when did we create this vampire that represents this moral struggle? At first I thought it was Buffy, and then I thought it went back to Anne Rice, but it really goes back 45 years to Dark Shadows and the vampire Barnabas. Dark Shadows started in 1966, but Barnabas didn't appear until well into 67, and the word vampire was never used until 68, and so I started thinking about those years. In 1966, Stuart Brand, the man who founded the Whole Earth Catalog, one of the most significant environmental journals, took an LSD trip on the rooftop of a San Francisco building. He was meditating on something Buckminster Fuller had once said, that the root of man's misbehavior was the notion that our Earth was flat and infinite. On LSD, he suddenly felt and saw the curve of the Earth. When he came down, he printed up a political button and sent a couple hundred all over the world, to NASA, to Soviet and US diplomats, to members of the United Nations and members of Congress. The button had this sentence: "Why have we not yet seen a picture of the whole Earth?" While there were a couple of fuzzy views from satellites, it would take Apollo 8 in 1968 to give us that color picture of the Earth rising. And 4 years later, another Apollo gave us the picture of the blue marble Earth, which may well be the most reproduced photograph in history. Those photographs changed us. At first, we saw just no boundaries, and we are all brothers and sisters. But eventually, we understood the darker vision. We saw our vulnerabilities for the first time. We saw ourselves as compromised morally, standing on this fragile planet and not doing what we need to do to save her. 1970 was the first Earth Day, the real beginning of the environmental movement, as we suddenly saw the Earth's fragility, a tiny ball of brilliant color in a dark universe, a ball so small the astronauts could blot it out with their thumb. They all noted it, and we all changed. Our vampires changed at the same moment. This image changed us and our thinking. I think the vampires so many are identifying with allow us to look at ourselves more clearly, to see the compromises we make daily, the moral struggles we often lose or more commonly deny. Sylvia Plath wrote, "I'm terrified of this dark thing that lives in me." And Stephen Moore in The Vampire in Verse writes, "The reason you can't see a vampire in the vampire is a mirror, reflecting our secret self." Hopefully, these morally conflicted vampires will allow us not only to see our abuses of power more clearly, but give us a few insights on how we can struggle to live more morally on this earth. And now, when someone says to me, "How could you waste 3 years reading vampire novels?" I paraphrase something that the late great science fiction writer Philip K. Dick once said, that when the divine is exiled from much of our culture, sometimes you have to look for it in the trash. Blessed be.
Blessed be. The Vampire Sermon, delivered by Margot Adler. She did some variants on that, and if that captured you in any way, shape, or form, you can check out her ebook called Out for Blood, published by and available on Amazon.com, and her print book that came out in March from Weiser Press, I believe Samuel Weiser's. That is entitled Vampires Are Us, and you heard her invoke that quote during the sermon. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. We are a wounded station. We are wounded financially. We need your calls and pledges, by the way, at 212-209-2950. I encourage you to become a WBAI buddy for $10. And you can call that number, 212-209-2950, and they will tell you more about it. But we are wounded in other ways, and we are taking these 3 hours, possibly a little longer, out tonight to discuss some of those wounds and celebrate the life of yet another person who has been taken from us. In the last week alone, we lost Brother Eddie Ellis, who was on Sunday afternoons. But Margot Adler died on Monday. And for me, this is a particularly grievous and egregious blow. If you look at so many of the obituaries that have been published yesterday alone. The New York Times, the Daily News. Let me look at some of the ones posted on her website. I did the posting. WBAI did a piece co-written by Manya, who just left here, and Linda Perry. Current.org did a piece of Voodoo, which is the about Margot and science fiction from this is an article that was written by Matt Staggs and is in Random House. The Jewish Daily Forward by WBAI alumni John Kalish on the Jewish angle and Margot and paganism. Margot's family, her grandfather, Alfred Adler, the famous Adler. So many people, we talk again about Amanya was using the pedals, go through the psychiatric circles. Alfred Adler, as in Freud, Adler, and Jung. That Adler, that's her grandfather. I would rearrange the mailboxes at WBAI when we had enough room for mailboxes. There was a fellow by the name of Bill Young, Y-O-U-N-G, who worked at BAI. I rearranged the mailboxes, so we had Freund, Adler, and Young. But Margot was legitimate. One time, in fact, she was covering some psychiatric event or other. She was interviewing, as a matter of fact, oh, why am I blanking on his name? The famed psychiatrist wrote The Use and Meaning of Fairy Tales, Bruno Bettelheim. And at one point she was following something where Freud's granddaughter was on stage at this event, and this woman got up and asked a question. And she said, yes, hi, coincidentally, I am the granddaughter of Carl Jung. And Margot shrieked. She'd stop the entire proceedings. And after, you know, the bit of the commotion settled down, it was realized that here were these three women, the granddaughters of Freud, Adler, and Jung. We're together. And, I mean, things that happened around Margot were truly magical in so many ways. Deadline Hollywood did a piece. CU News, Margot annually attended the conference on world affairs at Boulder, Colorado. Pathos, which is a website about faith and has a pagan channel, at least three people there have remembrances and words. Some of them are really nice. WNPR News had a good piece. SheKnows.com, Star News Online, Thalassa Musings. That's obviously the name of a blog. Pagans Tonight Radio, which is a long tribute. It is internet radio. And unfortunately, as so much internet radio, not fabulous audio quality, but well worth listening to. David Hinckley did a piece in the New York Daily News and the New York Times. And these were just the ones that I found offhand. There will be more. The impact that Adler had on so many people in so many ways was astonishing. The number of lives, the number of worlds that she touched. There are so many stories, and yet I'm finding, I mean, I knew this woman well, really well, from about 1968 through about 1980. We were especially through from 68 through 75, 76, before she found the man who would become her husband, John Glideman, who was also a good friend of mine. And he and I worked together writing some tech pieces and things like that. We were fairly inseparable for at least 8 years or so. And these were the most important formative years of my life. And she really, you know, thank God I had an older brother who did a lot of teaching and all that. But then I had the older sister. And that was Margo, eight years older than me. My brother's 4 years older. Margo's 8 years older than me. And, yeah, she was that older sister with whom she and I could share without even talking. It was, you know, yes, I'm boasting, yes. But I'm people who know me, this is before this loss. This is what I talk about. When I would have her at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings as a host, as a participant, when I helped bring her to LunaCon, the New York Science Fiction Convention this year, when I talk about her on Hour of the Wolf, this radio show that she created, it is boasting with pride and thankfulness that I knew her then, and with great, great sorrow at her loss. I never got her into Doctor Who. That was the next step. I did manage to get her into Buffy. I can try. It was said in the Jewish Daily Forward that I take credit for turning her on to paganism. That's true, and it's not true. What is true was that I was aware, this would be about 1970, late 72, I believe. I was aware of the fact that BAI was on 62nd and 1st, and on 59th Street. You're going towards the 59th Street Bridge, not the Edward Koch or Koch Bridge or whatever, but the 59th Street Feelin' Groovy Bridge. There was a place called the Blessed Bee Shop. Now, I hope I don't get these confused. In Brooklyn, there was the Warlock Shop, which is run by her close friends, well, became her close friends. Ed and Hermes, but this is the Blessed Bee Shop, which is funny because it had a little bit more to do with, well, darker magic and Satanism and stuff like that, where the Warlock Shop, using a name that is dark, Warlock, often doesn't mean a male witch necessarily. That's more in fantasy. Warlock has more to do with being a traitor to the religion is what warlock often means. So there was a woman by the name of Witch Wally, W-A-L-L-I. And this is before Marion Weinstein, another witch, was doing a regular program on Wicca and witchcraft at WBAI. And I heard about this. I saw, I don't know, classified, a flyer or something. It was right in the neighborhood. So I said to Margo, hey, let's go over. Might be fun. So we went. And I thought, okay, that was cool. I didn't realize that, you know, somebody calling themselves a witch, like, you know, didn't have a broom, was actually a bona fide earth religion, matriarchal, very cool thing, candle magic, and the threefold law, what you do shall come back at you three times. Do good, you will receive good. Do evil, you will receive evil. There's a code of ethics within neo-paganism. I think it shares that a great deal with Judaism, whether you accept it, like you have secular Jews. I might call myself, I'm a secular Jew, I might also call myself a secular neo-pagan. I do not practice it, but I do endorse it. And I will say blessed be to people and mean it without any shame or fear that I don't belong. So when I left, I thought, oh, this is very cool. And I sort of turn around and say, Margo, it's gone. It's time. But she was staying. And I'm not talking about this in terms of she just stayed there to learn more, which she did. I mean, she stayed there. So that was really the beginning of Margo discovering the craft. So, did I introduce her to the craft? I don't know. It's very possible that she was looking. This is before she went to England and started, you know, learning about Gardnerian traditions and stuff like this. This is, in fact, what helped prompt her to do that. So, I don't know that this wasn't already in her head, that she was looking for an opportunity to get this. But I can at the very least say I was with her at this time that was formative for her. And it was formative for her as an adult. I guess I would have been at that time about 18 or 19. She would have been about 26. So these are very heady years. These are very, very important times for Margo and for myself. And we shared those. We shared insane and wonderful beliefs. We shared the idea that we could reshape clouds. Because clouds are easy to manipulate, right? And magic, that's with K, M-A-G-I-C-K. It was an attainable thing, especially if she and I, and occasionally Gary Fried, another friend of ours, who WBAI friend who died of AIDS in the early 80s, would work together to do these things and say, okay, we're going to create, you know, look at that cloud there. We're standing on a street corner in Manhattan and say, okay, we're going to change that cloud. And we believed that it worked. Heady stuff that was going on, and some of it going on the air. You know, you could hear it in us as it was being reflected on the air in what we did. But this is also the kind of stuff that Margo would talk about freely on the air. As Manya said, with that amazing curiosity. But to me, it wasn't just curiosity. It was insight that drove her curiosity. It was insight as to where things could and should take her. There were so many confluences and influences on my life that brought her and I together in so many ways. As I pointed out, we can demonstrate that we performed at the same concert when I was 10 years old. I can believe that there was a time that we met before I was fully one and she was about 8. And there seems to be good but not documentable reason to follow up on that story, and something that her father more or less confirmed. Margo didn't even remember it. I would tell this to people. She's going, what? You sure, Freund? That didn't happen. And it's like, yes, it did. And I would recount the tale. This happened at least twice, but she would go, yeah, I suppose, I guess that did happen. It is an amazing story. I'm sorry, I can't tell it on the air. And we're not sure about the business that we went to the same camp the same year. It might have been a year apart. But certainly by 1968, at which point I was 14 years old, I was cutting school in order to be near this person and in order to be at WBAI, where Baird Searles was working on with people like Samuel R. Delaney, who was producing The Star Pit, which was, by the way, the original agenda for tonight's broadcast. And I will talk to the powers that be to see if we can do that soon. Chip Delaney, Samuel R. Delaney, will be the guest on this program, by the way, in December, assuming the station survives long enough for us to be here in December and that the powers that be grant me the airtime. And by the way, again, pledge 212-209-209. 2950. WBAI was an amazing, amazing place. Okay, I have some recordings. This is this is not properly edited, okay? But I do have here a recording from An Hour of the Wolf not that long ago. This is from January 19th, 2012, okay? Well, which is approximately the 40th anniversary of Margot beginning Hour of the Wolf. And let me see if I can cue it up near the beginning where she is talking about... No, it's proper to have that howl. That's okay. Let's see. Okay, we're getting close here. Margot's talking in my head. She will always be doing that. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Okay, let's join in progress a little bit of Margot talking about the how she came to create Hour of the Wolf.
And here we are. I'm returning to what was the best job of my life. There's no question in my mind that this was the most wonderful thing I ever did, doing this show. And let me start by just telling a little bit about how it all came to be, which was in 1972, 40 years ago. I'm Margot Adler, and I had come to BAI, to WBAI, in 1968. And I started out as a newscaster. And I did the 11:30 newscast, and then I went and ran their Washington Bureau for 8 months until I couldn't stand it anymore. And somewhere around and then I came back and I was a public affairs producer and some other things. And somewhere covered the Black Panther bomb conspiracy trial, did a lot of the kind of newsy things. And somewhere, while I was in Washington, I'm not exactly sure, you know, time has a weird way, 40 years ago, of sort of mixing and mashing and doing weird things. But somewhere, I read a column by Russell Baker. And that column by Russell Baker said, I don't exactly remember its exact words, but the basic gist of it was this, that, you know, there'll always be an earthquake, and there'll always be a coup, and there'll always be, you know, I don't know. Anyway, you know, who's going to remember your congressman in 50 years? But an archaeological find, a scientific discovery, stories that are more eternal, let's put it that way, are much more interesting. And I went, yes. I was so sick of news, which is an interesting thing to say since I'm still in the news business. But I was really sick of it, and I wanted to do something else. But at that time at WBAI, there were very few women who were doing shows that were what we might call free forum live radio, which was being spearheaded by Bob Fass and by Steve Post and by Larry Josephson and later by Paul Gorman. And there were Julius Lester. And the only women who were doing this was Mickey Waldman, Liza Cowan. That was basically...
And Carol Rettner,
yes. But when did Carol Rettner begin? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, but I mean, the live radio that we're talking about, very personal. I mean, Liza was doing it as the first lesbian women's show, and Mickey had her own way of being.
Mickey came a little later, didn't
Mickey
she?
Mickey came later, yeah, you're right. So it was really Liza Cowan was the real groundbreaker of all of this.
Was Electra Rewired her show?
I think so, yeah. So...
So I remember feeling that I wanted to do live radio, and I even had the fantasy. I even had that theme song in my mind, you know, when I saw Silent Running or where I saw the album or whatever.
Well, you and I were together when you saw it, when you found the album. We were in the 69 cent shop.
Were we really?
We were.
I don't remember this at all.
Yeah, I remember exactly which bin it was in.
Well, what I do remember was that I didn't have the chutzpah. I didn't have the guts to just go up to the program director, which was Goodman. I mean, the stage manager was Goodman at the time, I think, right? I don't even remember who was the program director at the
time. This is before Ninette Renone, wasn't it?
It was a man. I'm sure it was a man.
Yeah.
And I didn't have the chutzpah. No, I didn't have the chutzpah to go up to whoever it was and sort of say, I believe in myself. Give me a show. I'm really wonderful. Because way down deep, I didn't know. You know, I had no idea if I could do this. And I wasn't sure of myself. And also, I didn't really feel I had the right. So I went. But I've always been what I would call a creative oozer. You know, you're standing in a line. It's a very New York thing to do. You're standing in a line, and suddenly you're three people ahead, but you didn't move. There's so, you know, sort of like you go in the little spaces and you're just suddenly standing there and you're suddenly just a little ahead.
You didn't cut in line.
I oozed, right? So I've always been a very creative oozer. And so I went up to whoever it was, Goodman or whoever it was, and I said, you know, Larry Josephson comes in the morning at around, you know, 7 o'clock, and Bob Fass, the way it worked was Bob Fass could go off the air anytime he wanted.
Anytime after 3.
Yes, but he would, you know, often it was 5, sometimes it was 4:30, sometimes it was 4:45, and then the station would be dark, and at 7 o'clock, Larry Josephson would come in and do his show. And so I said, no one's using pretty much 5 to 7.
Those days, we turned off the transmitter.
We actually turned it off. We were not a 24-hour station. And I said, give them to me. And I even said, fire me. Because I was, at that point, a public affairs producer and an announcer. I said, fire me. I'll go on unemployment. And I will start the show. And if you like it, you can hire me back. And that's how the show started. And the show was not originally a science fiction show. It was a kind of everything show. But there was a kind of, I would say it was a mixture of feminism, spirituality, pagan spirituality, science fiction, environmental stuff, politics or whatever. It was that. And so there'd be everything. There'd be, you know, palm readers would come on and authors would come on and environmental people would come on and a lot of feminists would come on and science fiction writers would troop on. And so it was all those different things. And there were also phone calls. But
okay, well, that is but a taste. That is the beginning of a 3-hour program, okay? And it is but a taste. Depending on whether the listener shows up or not, we're going to be hearing a different episode of Hour of the Wolf, the last episode of Hour of the Wolf in the Hour of the Wolf, 5 to 7 a.m., as Margot had created it. But I can't tell you. That's a little taste. And I'll tell you what's different here. I was going to make this point, and of course I sidetracked myself, which I'm always doing. I'm always digressing, even from myself, not to mention sometimes guests or whatever. A point that I was going to make earlier when I was talking about most of those different obituaries of Margot Adler, most of them are about the woman who everybody knows from All Things Considered. That's the gorilla in the room. That's the thing that we haven't touched upon too much on this program. I'm actually trying to balance that a little. But Margot is one of the very first people at National Public Radio. She goes on to talk about that in this interview, and that will be not interview. She's my co-host in this talk. And of course, became one of the initial producers at All Things Considered. She applied to be host of All Things Considered and was turned down. She believes that it had discrimination involved, the fact that she was an out Wiccan, that she was, you know, known as a witch, and that this would possibly harm her credibility. I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm saying this is what she believed. She's quoted as that. So, lawyers, get off my back. This is in print any number of places, including in the obituaries. But what most of the obituaries do not cover are the Pacifica years. The fact that from 1968 through the present, Margot was never fully away from WBAI. And for several years, she was working for both NPR and BAI. She was a stringer doing reports for ATC. And at the same time, she was doing Unstuck in Time on Monday nights here at this station. She had done Midnight to Five slots, Far Side of the Moon. Everywhere she went, I took her leaving. She created Hour of the Wolf. I took over and still have Hour of the Wolf, even albeit in a very, very different time slot. She did Unstuck in Time, Midnight to Five. I eventually took that over. And actually worked with other people who I produced that show with other people after she left, including Frank Heller and the Family Electric Theater and some very interesting radio of the late 70s. And then when she left Unstuck in Time, because NPR, when she went on staff, did not want her moonlighting. They thought that it was not good form that she would be heard on, say, WNYC. She didn't work for NYC. She worked for NPR. Remember, these are two different entities. People sometimes don't quite realize that. NYC is located downtown. NPR, where Manya, who was here earlier, and where Margo and other good friends work, is on 42nd Street. And, you know, obviously there is cross-fertilization, but they are completely different entities. So suffice it to say that it was not good form, they believed, and I can see their point, for her to be basically moonlighting. So I am compensating with talking about the Pacifica years, talking about her affiliation with BAI, and you heard her, but 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, saying that this was the best job of her life. And that is what WBAI has provided her and me and many, many, many people. And we are all unpaid at this. Well, Margot was paid when she was a PA and news producer. PA is public affairs and news producer. But we don't get paid for doing our shows. And again, that makes me remind you to call the pledge line, 212-209-2950. One of the reasons I'm not getting better time slots is I am told I don't raise money. Well, let's let that not be true. Obviously, this is not a pitching program, but we cannot ignore the imperative future, the imperative that there is a future for this radio station. So please call that number and pledge. I'm going to play some music. And at that point, if you care to join the discussion about Margot, especially if you're somebody who knew her and have specific stories to tell, you can call on the air. And don't bother calling now, because the way this phone system works is, to use the technical term, totally meshuggah. So we're going to hear a song. There are any number of songs that are sort of like the official Hour of the Wolf songs, favorite songs that both Margot and I had. And Here is another one. I played something from the Kinks last week, and we will match it with something from the Kinks this week. Except that, again, it didn't queue up properly. Okay. Weird interface. But here we go.
Let me take you on a little trip. My supersonic ship's at your disposal if you feel so inclined. Well, all right. Travel faster than light, so drop your overcoat tight, and we'll go anywhere you want to decide. Well, all right. Nobody has to be helped. Nobody needs to be out of sight.
Oh, out of sight, man.
Nobody's gonna travel second class. There'll be equality and no suppression of minorities.
Are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The name of this program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a program that was created in 1972 by Margot Adler, who left us all too early at the age of 68 this past Monday, declared deceased at 10:30 in the morning after a nasty bout with cancer, not long after her husband, another good friend, John Glideman, had died of cancer. They leave their son, Alex Glideman Adler, and our hearts and minds and energy go out to Alex. This is a difficult time for everybody, but, you know, Lord knows what he's going through. If you have stories, hopefully cheerful ones, I'm getting morose here, about Margot, questions, answers, telephone number to call on the air is 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. And I would be very interested in people's input. By the way, as I was talking to Manya, I have every intention and hope of producing something that is more than just me blathering about how much I love this extraordinary person and sharing some anecdotes and not sharing some which can't be shared. And by the way, not for interpersonal reasons, but believe it or not, for, well, international reasons. Important reasons, at any rate. If you have photographs, if you have memories, if you have incidents and things that could go on her website or can be recorded eventually to go into a memorial documentary that I would like to produce, send them to me. My email address is jfreund. That's first initial, last name, J-F-R-E-U-N-D. Or if you like, you can make it Jim, but jfreund is surer to get to me. Jim will also get to me at, that's the at sign, Our Wolf. HOURWOLF.com. J. Freund or Jim at OurWolf.com. And be persistent. During that last song, I was looking to see if I had gotten an email from Lister, trying to find out whether or not he's coming in this morning. Because he had offered, graciously offered up his time for more rebroadcasting of Margot's materials. And I see a number of emails from people who are very important to me in my spam filter, which I don't necessarily always get to. And if I have not responded to you all, A, I have been very busy. The amount of talk about Margot, especially in social media like Facebook, not so much on Twitter, but definitely Facebook, and even on Reddit, there has been a good amount in most places except Twitter so far, it would seem. Has been viral. There was a point yesterday where Margot Adler's name was actually trending. You know how the top stories that are going on, the top gossip or something like that, are considered trending? The news of Margot's leaving us has been a trending story. It has caused so much of a change in the force, if you will. That's another thing I shared with Margot. Margot and John and I and Gary Fried, the four of us, went to the very first screening ever of Star Wars. We don't, you know, if you want, you youngsters, you can call it Star Wars Episode 4. And that is okay. That's how it's known now. But at the time, 'twas just Star Wars. And we went to, like, you know, I think it was the 9 a.m. screening. We stayed in our seats. You know, later on, they were chasing everybody out. We stayed in our seats to see at least through the first hyper jump for the second screening. At that point, we saw all the science fiction fans coming in and joining us. We was there first, and I was with Margot for that. Very, very important, very seminal moment in my life. I went with Margot and John also to see Sweeney Todd on Broadway, the actually not the very original production, but Angela Lansbury was still in it, but it was no longer George Hearn. It was Len Carreyrou, but it was, again, a very important part of my life. I'm a huge Sondheim fan, and I got to share that with Margot and John and so forth. I find it hard to believe that nobody is calling to share stories or talk. Again, the telephone number here is 212-209-2900. And I'm going to start believing soon enough that if we get no calls, that it is maybe the phones aren't working. Let me try from my cell phone. I don't trust any bit of equipment here. If you were listening at the beginning, you know that we couldn't even get a bit of music queued up to play on the air. So I have so much trouble with so many interfaces here. There we go. Mm-hmm. 1212. I don't have to hide the phone number I'm dialing. 209-2900. And let me press dial on that on my phone. And, ah, dear. Okay. I am dialing that number. Do I get a ring? It's not ringing through. So, for all of my wish and hope to have this be a more interactive show with you listeners participating, it seems like, thanks to the wonders of technology here at WBAI, that maybe we're not getting our phone calls. Yeah. There's a light. For all I know, that's me calling. But let's see if I can. If there's a person on the other end, let me press that button. Hello, hi there. Are you a person?
Yes.
Oh, thank God.
Or at least you know can believe that if you want to.
Well, yes, I choose to. But I was beginning to feel like I'm in a void. Even WHCR across the hall, they have their lights out, so I am very alone here at CCNY.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Well, you know, in a way, it's actually appropriate because this is the way in the Adlerian days that we used to do Hour of the Wolf. We'd have all the lights out.
And during the Jungian days, how did you do it?
I was pretty young at the time.
Okay.
But, and again, I point out, when you say Adlerian, Margot.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, okay, fine. She qualifies. She earns the title.
So I didn't hear all of it. I'm curious, do you admit to, or did you at any point just plain have a crush on her?
Huh. Well, sexually, no. Perhaps, maybe. But it almost transcended that. We never had any kind of sexual thing
going. No, I didn't think
going,
you did.
But a crush, yeah. I mean, I would say it transcended that. Mm-hmm. I had deep, deep love. How's
like
that? That goes beyond crush, doesn't it?
No, well, I don't know about beyond, but it's something different to a simple crush.
Yeah, I mean, as one would have love for an older sister.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody
right.
Who was that.
Right, you didn't have one.
Yeah, I didn't have one. I had an older brother who was very important to my formative years. But at some point, I was more estranged in many ways from my family. And mm-hmm. my new family became WBAI. I dropped out of high school to be at WBAI.
Once at a chaplain's table at a school where I went to graduate school, there was a guy who had been the coach of the Israeli fencing team.
Whoa.
And who just barely, I think by mistake or because of a scheduling conflict, didn't end up going to Munich with them. And he said that his family were from Austria originally, and that his father had a great commitment to social justice, and so he settled the family in the poorest, roughest, blackest neighborhood he could find, and was a doctor there, and it was hell for him. And inside the house, it was like Wiener Gemütlichkeit circa 1925. And outside, it was not pleasant at all for him, and he found himself gravitating away from his home. And to be honest, I thought of you for a second.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to delve too deeply. All I can say, really, is
I don't mind, but go ahead.
All I can say from Ms. Adler is I loved her spirit. I liked her voice. And it's a tribute to that that I could tolerate her talking what I consider to be, with all sort of similar talk, religious nonsense for minutes or sometimes hours on end. Because I shouldn't discriminate. I mean, they're all nonsensical and bad for us, I think. But Gardnerianism, I mean, especially, I mean, something that Aleister Crowley ghost wrote and whose ancient traditions were largely created 60 years ago is...
Crowley, he was more than 60 years ago, wasn't he?
Well, he did the ghost writing circa 1920, I think.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's a reason that it's neo-paganism. No, especially, have you read Drawing Down the Moon?
Yes, well, at least one of the versions of it.
Yeah, okay. Well,
she does point out that there are people who...
it is a self-made religion, absolutely.
But there are people who don't admit to that, honestly. And, you know, there were people who, I can recall in that book an interview with some woman who said something like, oh, in Ireland in the pagan days they were so advanced they had sex in the streets, which is both historically inaccurate and a really stupid value judgment. But again...
And P.S., by the way, I'm not sure that she would disagree with you.
Hmm?
I'm not sure that Margo would disagree with what you're saying.
True, but she didn't call her on it, and I mean, I think that there's a tendency, well, I mean, I know being of Jewish origin, that when you're a member of an unpopular minority group, not to, you know, not to criticize sometimes or not to call out absurdities when they're there. But
it's a Jewish thing. It's a pagan thing. It's a very WBAI thing.
Well, I think there's a similar... There must be a joke about paganism similar to the old joke about the Esperanto conference, where people from all across the world joined to speak the common language they all knew, which, of course, was Yiddish.
Right.
No, that...
yeah.
But
not that much of a joke, is it? It's pretty true.
Again, she had a questing mind. I don't think she was entirely credulous at any point, and I think she had some interesting things to say about vampires. But
that's something, by the way, I don't buy into the whole vampirism thing. I never have, largely because, and this was the subject of discussion on the air last week, I don't like gore. My best friend, not my best friend, one of my closest friends, Terrence Taylor, who's often been on the show, has written 2/3 of his vampire trilogy, which Margot rated well, by the way. And the first of the two books is very gory. It's very, oh my God, I had trouble getting through it, but... I don't go for that. Margot, you know, she loved the real.
I called in.
I think the word is crap.
I think it was still Saturday, and I was amazed she had never read Sunglasses After Dark, which was kind of a crucial '80s vampire novel.
Yeah,
unfortunately, kind of splatterpunk for too much for your taste, I'd say, and to some extent mine, but it was really the beginning of a very different tack on the whole thing. And I think she agreed with me that actually in the past couple of decades, vampirism has been more about cruelty than about blood. She said power, but in particular, cruelty.
Well, power can invoke cruelty, yeah.
Well, no.
Or rather,
cruelty. In 1984, O'Brien says the only way to prove that you have power is to make someone else suffer and have them not be able to stop you.
Yes.
So it connects there. I'll miss her voice. I'll be blunt. There was a time when I listened to Pacifica nearly all the time. I lived, I was listening to KPFK after a pseudo-Maoist coup there in the early 80s. I listened to it hours and hours a day during the early first Reagan administration, and I thought the world was going to end every day. And also, I got very tired of identity politics and the belief that just because people were marginalized, they were good, and a lot of other things that I'm sure you could speak to for hours, but probably off the air. But the thing is, I did like the Pacificaness that she brought.
I like the Pacifica niche. I like that term.
Yeah. well, the Pacificish.
Yeah.
Pacificish kite.
Yes.
That she brought to NPR, which always has been a little bit too, or at least in the past couple of decades, too sort of suburban self-satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Every report about a problem on NPR generally has to have some ameliorating thing about why it might all work out, or even indicating, well, yeah, you know, there are saner heads looking at this, and it will, you know, you can at least think it'll work out for the moment, which is, you know, in itself a good contrast to the way Pacifica can get. But even so, I mean, I liked the note of Pacifica she introduced to NPR better than Nonstop Pacifica.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you know, NPR really, you know, with people like Neil Conan, who, of course, you know, came from BAI, and...
Yeah, but once he was on NPR, he became very dismissive of any point of view not in the Overton window. I liked him on Talk of the Nation somewhat, but he tended to be very nasty to anyone who was even a little bit crankish. And sometimes the cranks are the people, you know, who are at least can shed new light on something.
Given his roots from here,
maybe he got tired of it.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, my earliest hearings of Neil Conan and meeting him certainly was when he was doing Of Unicorns and Universes with Baird Searles. And when he was an occasional co-host with Margo on Hour of the Wolf. And he's very, very important to the formation of... All Things Considered and NPR in general. And there was a time when it was more like the old WBAI news, which...
Mm-hmm. Yes, at the very beginning, back when the theme was the weird sort of unpleasant synthesizer thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
Yeah, I mean, there are other things, and like Terry Drinkwater was, I think, the first station manager at KPFK, and was a big force on, I think, NPR for a while. Maybe I'm confusing
it. Sounds right.
He was with CBS. So, no, there has been an influence.
Yeah.
And did she ever do any television?
No.
Oh, that's too bad.
It is too bad.
She could have livened up a news hour or whatever.
Tell me about it. Tell the world about it. Yeah, I mean, there are many, many things. Like I was bemoaning the fact that she never wrote fiction, and she could have been great. She could have done television. I don't know if that ever occurred to her, if she ever tried. Also, she was, I think, stretched enough being a wife, a mother, an NPR correspondent, and more than that, she did a... she always denied that she was the bureau chief of New York, but I do know that there was a time when she was one of the head honchos of, you know, the office. This is before John got sick and then her getting sick and all that. But there was a time when many, many people in the New York office reported to her. I know nothing about NPR. I've had one piece on there ever, and that's because of her. And even then, that was about some science fiction convention. I do not pretend to have her chops, as it were, but I have visited there a couple of times. I've seen what's gone on. I'll name another great BAI name who's done a lot of good work at NPR and on television, and that's Robert Krulwich.
Yes.
Big fan of his, I must say. Another.
I'm curious, was he ever involved with Shortcuts?
No, I don't believe so. I think it's just...
Because a lot of the production work on Radiolab is reminiscent to me of Shortcuts, which I've always loved.
Yeah, well, yeah, but Shortcuts is just, I shouldn't say just, it's Peter Beauchamp's thing.
Okay.
Now, whether or not one influenced the other, you may be more qualified to judge than I. And there, you know, obviously a lot of people influenced a lot of people. Margot is obviously the greatest influence on my radio life and some other facets of my life as well, but primarily my radio life. And yet I can never. I'm a host, okay? I'm not an interviewer. I'm not a journalist, although I've done a little of that. I was actually host of...
Better a host than a parasite.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. I'm going to use that one. Thank you. But what I mean by that is that I have learned how to provide a platform for a guest.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how to make a guest comfortable. I know how to get them, draw them out so that they sound good on the air. But I don't ask...
Often you do it by talking.
Yes.
I'm not...
No, that's exactly how I do it.
I've found that one way, and supposedly this is an old police trick, that one way to get people to get confessional is to start talking a lot yourself.
Mm.
And they may, you know, they may start talking out of sheer competition.
Yeah, yeah. Out of competition. And usually when I have a guest on the air, I try to meet them a minimum of a half hour before, if not an hour before, so we can be yapping away before we go on the air. And by the time we go on the air, we're warmed up, as it were, and that person is comfortable. And many people I talk to, especially because I'm dealing, I choose primarily to deal with science fiction writers.
Fairly often when that's come up in the course of an on-air segment, I wish you had an off-air check that you could run later with their permission.
Well, you know, if this show has to start moving toward either A, a podcast, or B, if I start creating, shall we say, the DVD extras for Hour of the Wolf, maybe I will do something just like that.
Well, I won't keep you on the line more because maybe someone else will want to call.
That would be nice. I'm very glad to have your voice this morning.
During one ReaderCon back in the Kirk Pollan days.
That's only 2 years.
Became, as someone I know now calls it, Wiscon East.
That's not unfair.
As I said to you then, I think it was right after they jerked you around in the schedule, in the timetable, that I think WFMU would love to have you. It's not like they've got a lot of people itching to go on in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Or even early morning Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in New Jersey.
Yes.
They even take some programs, you know, digitally, you know, well, by tape or digital analogs to those to tape.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be blunt. They are all free form. They're not beholden to any corporate foundations or to a cadre of people who tell them what to do. Their station manager is kind of cranky, but he's very open to people who don't agree with him. And
which is as it should be.
And I think I basically feel more live energy if far too many white people from the station than I do from BAI.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I can over the web listen to both of them, I'm afraid where I go is much more often FMU.
Mm-hmm.
But, that's as may be, and I hope you can stay at BAI because you've been with the station for so long, and the station would be the lesser without you. It'll be less without even...
There have been, in the last year, scenarios you've probably heard about Pacifica wanting to sell the station, to lease the station, which is not legally possible. I'm not sure a sale is legally possible, but I will tell you, because this is not a secret, that among... this doesn't seem hopeful at this point, or possible, but maybe hopeful, but not possible. There have been scenarios in which the management of WFMU would take over WBAI. I would, how do I put this, not be shedding a tear if that happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, their story is pretty inspiring. Or really, it's largely Ken Friedman's story.
Mm-hmm. That's
small college station. It's the college went under. It was the happiest thing he had ever done.
Ooh, you just reminded me of something. Is mentioning Uppsala, something that was sent to me from Fred Hershkowitz. And, oh, my God, he's very important about this, that WBAI totally beat WFMU in Uppsala College.
Library.
In softball.
Accident kept them from flooding. And, it's not like they had to relocate, but even so, they nearly went under, but they seem to be on a reasonable footing now.
Yeah, well, I've actually had issues about the relocation.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can imagine, I haven't said them all on the air.
For us on the outside, I think part of the problem of comprehending how bad things are with BAI is that over the years, it's often seemed to be some sort of slow-motion disaster or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so when things are really, really on the edge, it's...
As they are now.
Yeah, it's hard to distinguish from all the other times when things were on the edge.
Right.
You know, it's
crying hour of the... Are we crying hour of the wolf here?
What?
Are we crying hour of the wolf here?
No, boy.
Yeah, sorry. Feeble attempt.
And, so again, I'll miss her. I'm sorry she's gone. And thank you for giving tribute to her.
And thank you for your care
and
your bluntness.
You gave her enough opportunity to hear you do that while she was still around to hear it.
I
don't know if she did, but I hope she did, and I hope it pleased her.
Yeah.
I think it would have done.
I hope so, too. Well, thank you so much for calling. Get in touch with me off the air, would you?
Okay. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. And on the air, good morning. You are on the air. Hello?
Hey, Jim?
Yes. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. Dave Marks.
Good God. How are you?
Fine. Well, it's not like we haven't seen each other in the last 6 months.
Well, yes, but the time before we saw each other was, what, 25 years?
Maybe 30.
Yeah, and that was a point when you and I were working with Margot on the Council of Elrond.
Yeah. Among other things. Better reasons to be able to talk to you again in the course of 6 months, but...
Yeah, well, it's sort of horrible. I've been hearing from all these people that I've always wanted to hear from over the last few years, and all of them in the last 2 days. And it's, you know, I want to talk to these people individually, as I got to do with you at BEA at the book expo. And even then, we only got like 10 minutes, although a couple of good photos. You know, to have to talk under the circumstances of grief is sad.
Yeah. I mean, it's also the memories, though, you know.
And they're great memories.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, when you were talking earlier about, you know, all the various early day things, I was, first project I did with Margot, if you can call it a project, this is about October 73. It's the Watergate fans out there remember. I was one of those other people living in the balcony of the church.
That's right.
And I was, what, a year younger than you are, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
there were about four of us all told, wouldn't you say?
More or less.
Yeah.
So I was there Sunday morning when Margot came in. She was doing weekend news at that point. She came in to do the weekend news, and you know, we had heard about the start covering the Saturday Night Massacre because nobody else was around to cover it.
Right.
So, you know, 18, and yeah, I'm just going to be a part of the team, just work with, you know, just a level of acceptance on her part. I guess you broke the ice for everybody. all us punk kids who learned a huge amount from Margot and people like her.
Yeah, she was a mentor to so many people in so many ways.
Yep.
And I think will continue to be, you know, her legacy is not over.
Oh, absolutely not. But that's a good point about it. There's a lot out there. But a few happier memories or whatever. As you know, I've got, like, in Michigan, out in way beyond the orbit now. But, you know, driving around some years ago, listening to Wait to Me.
Now, say that again. Your phone's breaking up a little.
Sorry. Driving around on a Saturday morning, listening to Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Oh, right, yes.
Did you hear that episode that Margo guested on?
No, I did not.
It was hilarious.
Oh, I'm going to have to find that. But that reminds me, I was told by somebody in email that I knew that not long ago Margot had appeared on Bob Edwards' show on Sirius Radio. And apparently they have been rebroadcasting that show, that episode with Margot, fairly nonstop since Monday. So if you know anybody with access to Sirius Radio, check out Bob Edwards, and you can hear what was apparently a really great show with Margot that's maybe 2 months old.
Cool. And so far, apparently Peter Sagal nailed her down to the rumors that she had once done cannonballs in the swimming pool at some Disney resort during an NPR affiliates meeting or something like that.
I wouldn't know that. But you're the expert on Disney resorts.
I am. It's one of the reasons it resonated in other fantasy worlds.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was very nice. And, I may wander beyond the orbit. I mean, I'm beyond Pluto. These days, relative to everybody else, but it's always been nice to hear Margot's voice when I could hear it.
Well, I'm going to getting that voice in the future is limited, but I am going to be doing my utmost to bring that voice incorporated, if not into the show, into podcasts, into various forms. One of the things that I want to do is to try to digitize some of the old Hours of the Wolf and Unstuck in Times. Hours of the Wolf and Unstuck in Times. as it were. Her son would have most of those tapes. She had asked me some time back, you know, if I was digitizing mine, which I'm, you know, thinking of trying to find a way to do. It's very expensive. They have to be baked and all this stuff. There's a video. If you go to Facebook and the Hour of the Wolf page in there, you can find a video all about my tapes and the necessity of digitizing them and bringing them back.
Well, let's face it, the tape that we got for air checks back then was pretty poor to begin with. So, yeah.
Some of it, I mean, so I've got some of the Bonneville Muzak tapes.
Oh yeah, in the blue boxes.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a lot of those. I have a lot of things that need preservation, including episodes of free music store concerts.
Oh please, yes.
You know, not all of the greats, but some of them of those concerts.
Yes, does everybody know about the Door Gnome?
I don't think they do. I've got a couple of cool photos.
Do they want to know about it?
Sure.
There was a period that came back at the church
Preceding the church. I was the door gnome at Martinson Hall and at the Washington Square Methodist Church.
Right. However, that's for you to tell. For me to tell, for me, it was at the church.
Okay.
You know, because that was when it was happening for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was usually doing PA and occasionally doing the broadcast mix for the show at that point, and Jim was at the Door Gnome collecting quarters, nickels, dollars, whatever he could get, persuade people to put into a large bottled water jug.
Mm-hmm.
And for the sake of the AI, and we did that about twice a week for as long as the church lasted.
Yeah. Kenny Davis took a photo of me looking through that water jug and with my Jufro, I won't call it haircut because seldom was the haircut, but it's a funny and scary photo.
But he was shooting black and white. It would have been so much better in color.
Yeah, I agree. He also got some good photos of Margot.
Yeah.
Named his daughter Margot. Don't think that's coincidence.
Probably not.
Yeah. But, I love the days of the church. I love being the door gnome and being the Adler bunny. I was described in one obit as her intern, but I wasn't her intern. I was Baird Searles' intern. But I was her bunny, as we use the word bunny
you can say it if I don't.
For some of the people at the station, the word bunny was synonymous with groupie.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of a few people like Manya, who just left here, and and she says she was the only one who had bunnies. No, Margot had me. And I just saw a bunny as, you know, somebody, when somebody says hop, you hopped.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I would help engineer. I would help her with the air checks. I was her assistant, if you prefer. But I was also her co-host.
Yeah, I remember one or two times sitting in one of those little weird desk, the school desks with the gooseneck on it, with Margot behind the board and you sitting next to me.
Yeah.
I think we were talking about Tolkien?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I still try when I can get the time to play every year this broadcast of the Council of Elrond, and you were the one person who I didn't actually have access to that we who make up what made up that program, and that is the Council of Elrond. I hope people have heard it, and if not, we'll hear it, assuming that we have a future for it. And the this is a reading done by Baird Searles, who was fairly definitive. You were the Tolkien expert. You were the Lord of the Rings expert. Margot was, you know, the radio person, and I was the person who edited and still do readings. I now do that for Lightspeed magazine, putting out three podcasts every 2 weeks. And I get to edit actors reading great science fiction. So that actually brings me back to then. The difference is now I'm working digital, and then I was working with razor blades.
There are worse ways to make a living.
Yeah, and, you know, Searles pulled a fast one on me by giving me a phone number to call to get a pronunciation, which you already knew the answer to, but he wanted to freak me out, so he gave me a number to call to find out how to pronounce Gandalf. And, of course, I ended up being on the phone with Tolkien.
Yeah, why wasn't it the last?
Yeah, it was quite something. But that production is one of, is produced by yourself, Dave Marks, myself, Jim Freund, and Margot Adler, and read by Baird Searles. I would say that, along with one of the free music stores I produced with Peter Schickley, are among my crowning achievements.
Well, I think you have a few others out there.
But those are among the best.
Yeah, Redigore was fun, wasn't it?
It was fun. I don't have a recording of it, but it was great fun.
Finding it to Left Handed Darkness or something like that?
No. I did stuff with Chip Delaney post Star Pit. But no, Margot read portions of Left Hand of Darkness on the air. She read the folktale portions.
I know it was in there somewhere.
Yeah. And so, of course, I was involved in that. I engineered it, but that was Margot's doing.
Much more apropos.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, we're almost out of time. Lister's here, and I
have my uses, right?
Yes. But we are... This is not the last program of this nature that I'm going to do about Adler. She is... I do have a guest planned for next week, Sam Miller, who just won the Shirley Jackson Award for horror. Margot, by the way, is longlisted for Vampires Are Us for the Bram Stoker Award for related to horror nonfiction. And so that's all very cool and good. So and whatever I do on this program, as long as it lasts, her DNA will be a part of it.
Be part of all of us, really.
Really. And I'm so pleased that you called.
It's been good. The last time I called BAI, as opposed to did things, was probably about 72.
Whoa!
Called into Mickey's show. I was incredibly depressed about the election.
Yeah. And Mickey is another one who we have lost. And that was an almost unknown. I only found out about her due to a friend, a mutual friend, who was working on some kind of service. There to clean up her apartment, and discovered the air checks in this woman's apartment, and it turned out to be Marion Waldman, Mickey Waldman. And that was sad. to end that way.
Yeah.
But that will not be the case with Adler. Her, you know, she has a very, very strong legacy. I definitely advise people to visit MargoAdler.com. It's sort of bare bones, but I will be building it up over time.
Well, definitely keep building.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, that's M-A-R-G-O-T is the correct way to spell Adler. So that's the way to get to her website, MargotAdler.com. And I would appreciate photos and stories and tributes to put on that website. And you can contribute to that, Dave.
Well, I definitely jot something off. Do you have an email set up for that, or should I use your regular
email? My email, jfreund@ourwolf.com.
Yeah. Okay, I think I have it.
Yeah. And I have it written, but not linked on her website, but it's written there.
Very good.
All righty.
Okay.
So thanks so much. And be in touch, please.
Yeah.
I mean, off the air.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good.
For sure.
Okay, take care then.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, thank you for the offer, Lister, to run into your time. I was actually, I did end up being prepared. Did you get my phone messages?
No.
I was willing to go to 5 a.m. I was going to, because I would have had, I have a tape. It's 3 hours long. I would have started it at 2. When I say tape, it's a file. You know, so I would have, of an episode of Hour of the Wolf with Margot. And I would, it's a 3-hour episode, so I would have put that on at 2 and gone till 5. But that's fine. There will be opportunities in the future.
Well, in the future, do the whole stretch to 5.
I may at some point. I mean, Margot did 5 to 7 a.m. Excuse me if I'm talking automatically 5 to 7. She did a midnight to 5 show. And then I took that over as well. But it's been 20 years since I've done that stretch. There was one time, it's 2:59, it's almost 3 in the morning, so it's a time for you, but there was one time where I was on the air for approximately 17 hours nonstop. I was engineering shows and all that. Then came somebody. I was on, supposed to be on at 5 a.m. with Hour of the Wolf. And I was on the engineering shift until midnight. And then the midnight to 5 person didn't show up. And I was on the air. I had been on the air for a 17-hour stretch. And what I took a listener phone call. And this, I think, is unique in the annals of radio. I fell asleep on the air. While taking a listener call, I fell asleep, and I tried to cover it up. There was this person calling, and they were droning on and on and on. I just fell out of the air. And this person, all of a sudden, I hear in the headphones from the caller, Jim, I'm going, oh. Yeah, I'm sorry. I was just taking a reading, on the remote control unit for the transmitter. And the person said, "Do you usually snore when you do that?"
Yeah.
Ooh, talk about busted. Let me read an email that came from Fred Hershkowitz, formerly of WBAI, who got together our softball team because I was soliciting an email a few former BAI people. And he said, if you talk about our softball team, the WBAI Turtles, not named after their speed, but their looks and odor, and embellish a little, we actually became a potent became a potent and beat WNYC two times. And in one season, Dave Metzger hit a home run every time up. The smile on Margot's face as the balls whizzed past her, as she was the pitcher, and your shins, I was the second baseman, so nobly directing the ball over to Rick Harris. I was at first base. To think, no one ever thought a bunch of lefties could play ball. We beat Uppsala College Radio. You see, that earlier caller was saying how great WFMU is. And I'll say, yeah, okay, maybe WFMU, maybe Ken Friedman is really good. Maybe WUSB, where you work, is really good. But you know what? We whooped them in softball, okay? You can say how great WFMU is. We whooped them in the WBAI Turtles. We also beat McGraw-Hill, the Village Voice, and according to Fred Hershkowitz, we struck terror into the hearts of all opponents that Margot and you were so fine on that team.
Did they get to play the Soho News?
No, we never did. No, I don't think Soho Weekly News existed then, but Margot did write for the Soho Weekly News. She wrote a piece, a wonderful piece called Why Pitching for WBAI and Pitching for the New York Mets Are So Similar. And this is the point I mentioned on the air about the thing I was forbidden to discuss, Margot's intense crush on Tom Seaver, the pitcher. Not the Yankee. Well, yeah, he became the Yankee baseball announcer, but the Mets pitcher, damn it, Tom Seaver. And Seaver was a dissident on the team, talking about free agency and stuff like that, which is why he was traded away. And this is at a time when he was being berated by the Daily News journalist whose name I forget, and the PR director of the Mets was actually the son-in-law of that journalist. I remember his name, and all this stuff. And Margot drew all of these political parallels between the necessity to pitch for WBAI and the problems that Seaver had while he was pitching his best for the New York Mets. And she wrote that in the Soho Weekly News, and I do have a copy of that at home somewhere.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I'd like to see it myself. My basement is a horrifying mess of 10-inch reels, not only my 10-inch reels, some of Margot's 10-inch reels, books, well over 4,000 or 5,000 books easily, and
promo cards, right?
I'm sorry?
And you had promo cards in the basement too, right?
I had only a few carts, maybe 5 or 6 carts, but I have, you know, hundreds of hours of reel to reel and thousands of hours of cassettes. And reel-to-reels, mostly on 10-inch reels. I mean, this stuff cannot be played. And then I've got magazines, I've got playbills, I've got all this stuff. And trying to digitize some of it, but digitizing those tapes are tough. But yeah, if I find that copy of the Soho Weekly News, which, by the way, also had a gorgeous picture of Margot, there are a lot of gorgeous pictures of Margot. People do hunt through Facebook, but I'm collecting a lot of these pictures, and I'm going to put them at margotadler.com. And there's at least one that very, very few people have seen ever. I showed it to Manya earlier tonight on the air. Hope all of you listening in radio saw it. It's a picture of Margot in her high priestess garb when on the day that Margot married me. Let's see if I can come up with... There it is. There it is, Lister. Look at that. Is that gorgeous?
I like that.
Is that nice?
Yes.
That's the day Margot married me.
Wow.
And so that people are clear, that is to say, she officiated my wedding in 1979.
That's intense.
And so that's for my wedding.
Damn.
In 1979.
That's pretty outfit.
It's a gorgeous outfit.
Yeah.
Holding a flower and her athame. In front of her is the pagan altar. That's the witchcraft mm-hmm. altar there.
Mm-hmm.
And all that for the hand fasting. And it was quite an event.
She's such a spirited person, that picture.
Yeah. Yeah, that's her spirit right there. You can see it. And you know, check out that hair, check out that outfit, check out that smile. So as I get together all the different, oh, you want to see something scary? There's me on that same day.
Oh!
That's after cleaning me up. That's the woman who was my wife for 3 months.
Oh, congratulations. That's great.
Well, that was then. I mean, but the marriage only lasted like 3 months. There's the altar. I hope all of you are...
Where's the cake? Where's the cake?
Oh, the cake is that's the ceremony itself. Oh, that's okay. That's Margot actually officiating. Now, there's the cake right there.
All right.
Right there. No, that's wine. Where's the cake? There is a cake.
That's a pretty one.
Da-da-dum. There's Moshe Feder and Lisa Eisenberg, well-known fans, and Al Cobrin.
Where's this location?
This is Margot's apartment.
Wow, it's nice.
Nice. Margot has a legacy apartment in one of the great Upper West Side apartments. It's huge. Alex lives there now, of course.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully he'll be able to maintain that place. We'll see. Sure. But, I mean, I've been at events with over 150 people in her living room.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's her upstairs neighbor at one point was named Leonard Bernstein.
Wow.
So the book Radical Chic.
That's a beautiful apartment.
That's quite... you're just seeing the living room and the dining room are all that we have in these pictures. And I will eventually... There's a cake. You wanted cake, there's cake.
I want that picture.
Okay, well, I'm a diabetic now. I couldn't eat that today. And you notice those pictures in the background, those photos?
That's great.
Yeah. Gorgeous apartment.
Yeah.
Great people, great times.
Yeah.
Very heady. And... I won't release my part of the wedding pictures, but I will release at some point the picture of Margot as High Priestess, which is, although I've seen some pictures in the last couple of days that are just absolutely freaking magnificent, that people have, some that people have sent me and some that they've posted on Facebook. Her news of her passing has gone viral to the point where you go into Facebook and they had, you know, trending stories, top discussed topics on Facebook, all of Facebook throughout the world. One of them was Margot Adler. Well, you could say that's amazing, but in another way, no, it isn't. It's proper. She had that effect on that many people. And everybody's proprietary. I claim to know her better than everybody else. Manya can claim that truthfully. And so can so many people out there, people who I haven't met. And hopefully we will meet at some point. Hopefully.
It's her true legacy.
It is a true legacy. Yeah, absolutely. Her grandfather had an amazing legacy in psychiatry, as Margot said, he created the inferiority complex. Well, it's a term he coined. He coined the word lifestyle. He created the concept of the inferiority complex, Alfred Adler. And her father was one of the first premier Adlerian psychiatrists ever. So Margot, as the third person there, she has left quite a legacy as well. That whole family has done something. But to me, it is Margot.
Well, my condolences to you, Michelle, and her entire family and extended family.
And the WBAI family, who have lost Ellis and Robert Knight and Alambe Broth and all these people just in the last couple of months, for Christ's sake. For the gods' sake. It's very intense. And very sad. I don't buy it when people say such and such is in a better place. No, it's not. No, it's not. Even if there is another... Even if there is another place, neo-paganism does not tend to talk about the afterlife. They talk about, you know, what you do here. It's a religion of morality more than anything else. And that is something, and let me say this, and this is actually a good place to go out on. Something that one person said to me in the last couple of days, I don't remember exactly who it was, but it was great. And this person said, Margot had no enemies. Can you imagine? With all the lives she touched, all the politics she did, talking about witchcraft, talking about psychiatry, talking about music, talking about this and that, being on the radio, on National Public Radio, being on WBAI, being one of the formative people that made WBAI great. This is not a person who held back opinion. This is not a person who was shy about speaking out, especially, you know, it's one thing to be producing news stories for NPR. Okay, the newspapers get that. They talk about all the work she did on NPR. Fine, she deserves that. But she was us. She was Pacifica. She was WBAI. She was KPFA, news director at both stations. Creator of Hour of the Wolf, turned this into a 24-hour-a-day radio, that's correct, 24-hour-a-day radio station. Didn't happen before Margot.